Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the local impact of frozen federal funding and other cuts. Sullivan Fresh is trying to keep the community covered and the mobile farmers markets open through a series of fundraisers to make up for the lack of federal funding. And Action Toward Independence is worried they won't be able to provide critical special services to people with disabilities in need in the Catskills. We'll speak to both organizations. Plus, the Sullivan County Committee for Equity and Justice is gathering residents for a discussion on these divided times, hoping to find common ground. And we'll talk to the world record-holding mountain climber, who will be at the Frederick Cook Society tomorrow. That's coming up. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks opened mixed this morning as the Labor Department reported cooler-than-expected inflation last month. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 100 points in early trading.
Consumer prices in February were up 2.8% from a year ago. That's a smaller annual increase than the previous month and slightly less than forecasters had expected. Housing costs continued to climb in February, but gasoline prices were down for the month, while grocery prices held steady. There's no break yet in the price of eggs, however. They jumped more than 10% in February amid the ongoing shortage linked to avian flu. News of cooling inflation comes on the same day President Trump imposed 25% tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. Those and other import taxes threatened by the president could put more upward pressure on prices. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The European Union says it will retaliate for President Trump's new tariffs on aluminum and steel. EU officials say they will impose tariffs on about $28 billion worth of imported U.S. goods. These levies will begin April 1st. President Trump's efforts to downsize the federal government now include firing about half the workforce at the U.S. Department of Education. NPR's Janaki Mehta reports that's according to a statement from the agency.
The announcement says affected staff will be placed on administrative leave beginning March 21st. The statement confirms all divisions within the agency will be hit by cuts, but it also says the Education Department will continue to deliver programs protected by law, including, quote, student loans, Pell Grants, funding for special needs students, and competitive grant making. According to the announcement, 1,950 positions will be cut, including 600 employees who accept voluntary resignations over the last 2 months. Exactly who will be laid off is still unclear. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
The Kremlin says it is waiting to be briefed on yesterday's conversation between top U.S. and Ukrainian officials. They discussed ending Russia's war in Ukraine. Secretary of State Marco Rubio led the U.S. delegation. He says Ukraine has agreed to observe a 30-day ceasefire with Russia. Rubio says he expects to be in contact with Russian officials today.
We're going to bring it to them directly. We're going to say that Ukraine is prepared to stop all battlefield activity and begin the immediate process of negotiating an enduring end to the war. And we'll see what their response is. If their response is yes, then we know we've made real progress and there's a real chance of peace. If their response is no, it would be highly unfortunate, and it would make their intentions clear.
After the talks between the U.S. and Ukraine concluded yesterday, President Trump said he has restored intelligence sharing and U.S. military aid to Ukraine. This is NPR. Security officials in Pakistan say they've rescued nearly 200 people from a train hijacked by militants. There were more than 400 people aboard. The train was stopped yesterday as it drove through a tunnel. Nearly all the ballots are counted in Greenland's parliamentary elections. The political parties that want to seek independence from Denmark got the most votes. Greenland is getting a lot of international attention. Terry Schultz reports that's because President Trump has insisted he wants the U.S. to take over the world's largest island.
Independence from Denmark was not on the ballot, but Greenland's new parliament is likely to take it up quickly. With nearly all ballots counted, Greenland's center-right opposition party, Demokratiet, which is pro-independence, has taken the biggest share, almost a third. Another opposition party, Naleraq, also pro-independence, will come in second. The third highest vote-getter, the current ruling party, shares the same position. Greenland is a semi-autonomous territory in charge of its own domestic affairs, but with Copenhagen controlling its foreign and defense policy. Citizens have long debated seeking full autonomy, and in recent years, according to polls, it's become the majority opinion. Polls also show while Greenlanders no longer want to be part of Denmark, they don't want to join the U.S. either. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz.
NASA has launched a new telescope into space. The Sphere-X Observatory was aboard a rocket launched last night from Vandenberg Space Force Base in California. Sphere-X will work a little differently from the James Webb and Hubble telescopes. It will take in the total glow produced by all the galaxies it can see, including light from when the universe was born. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. This morning, we're going to bring you two stories about how the federal funding freeze announced by the Trump administration is destabilizing some local programs despite court interventions. In the wake of frozen federal funding, the Sullivan Fresh Food Security Program is grappling with these financial uncertainties, but remains committed to providing essential food resources to the community. The initiative is a collaboration between Cornell Cooperative Extension Sullivan County and Sullivan Allies Leading Together, or SALT. It's been a lifeline for many residents offering access to fresh, healthy food through the community cupboard and mobile farmers markets. But in February, all federal funding for the program was unexpectedly frozen, creating a significant setback for the effort to sustain these services. Melinda Meadow is the Ag and Food Systems Senior Issue Leader at Cornell Cooperative Extension Sullivan County, and she joins us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Let's remind folks about the Sullivan Fresh Food Security Program. I gave a little synopsis there, but talk about the mission and the impact that it has on the community.
Sure. So the program has two parts to it, like you said, the community cupboard and the Sullivan Fresh Market Program. And basically, it's a program to address food insecurity in the county, but also making connections between local farms and families in need, and ensuring that fresh local food reaches the community in Sullivan County. The Sullivan Fresh Community Cupboard serves over 700 individuals a week, and it really targets a lot of locations in food desert communities, and we use a farm-to-food pantry model where, with a lot of support from the regional food bank, we get a lot of shelf-stable products, but through different programs, through New York State and federal programs, we're able to work with farms to actually, buy food that's grown in our county and get that out to people on our route. And it's a mobile food pantry that does drive around to these different locations. The Sullivan Fresh Market Program is a seasonal program where we, again, work in food desert communities with our mobile farmers market, working with local farms, going into the community with a mobile van, setting up, and getting these products out. And then also we run the Sullivan Fresh Monticello Farmers Market. So again, working with farms directly to sell their products. And we use a lot of different incentive programs to make this program affordable, where we accept SNAP, Fresh Connect program. We partner with the Rural Health Network to the Sullivan Fresh Bucks, which is our own currency, where people attend nutrition educational demonstrations, which are open to everyone, to then receive Sullivan Fresh Bucks that they can then go buy those fresh fruits and vegetables they learned how to cook. So it's a really great program that not just gets food out into the community, but it really builds that relationship with neighbors and other community members, with Cornell, than the farmers as well.
The mission, and I guess the impact, is kind of right there in the name, food security. How much federal funding did you receive, and how have these frozen federal funds impacted the community cupboard and the mobile farmers market specifically?
Well, it's a combination of funding. We've had, donations in the past, different state program, and federal is a portion of it, not, entirely. We do one program that we've received funding from is the New York Food for New York Families, which is a New York State program, but federal funding comes from funding comes from the federal government, and that's basically a program where you can just buy, we buy directly from farms and then get reimbursed for that, and then those products are used in the cupboard. So going forward, that program has been halted. And then we also have a local food promotion program grant, which covers not just the Sullivan Fresh program, but also works with other farmers markets and on, you know, economic development for farmers in the county, helping them to increase their sales for direct markets and wholesale markets. So this program fell under that because we would offer wholesale training, publicity, technical assistance related to direct sale wholesale marketing for farmers. So that program has been paused, as of now.
Just picking up on that, does that mean that someone who might regularly go to the community cupboard can't go there now because the funding's not there?
Nope. Right now we are, we have, operational funds that we are using, to support the cupboard. So it is still operating right now.
But you know that you need that funding that was supposed to come in order to continue, right?
Correct. Yeah. Yep. So we were, there is right now a limit on the amount of products we can get from farms without the funding. We still have access to the food bank. And then as part of the Sullivan Fresh program, just to help reduce, or the market program to reduce costs, we are cutting back on some of the stops for that.
Well, with this period of financial uncertainty, knowing that you want to keep serving the community, what are some steps you're taking to ensure the continuation of these essential services?
So we are launching a fundraising program that'll have a few different components to it. We're going to have some different events every month. We have one coming up, a cooking class in our teaching kitchen. We have some local chefs that are donating their time and working with farms to teach these cooking classes. And the proceeds from those classes will go to the community cupboard and the market program. Another one we're working on is making bread. We're going to work with a farm to do a paella cooking class, things like that. And then as well working with the Coshecton Fire Station, they're doing some special events for us. And in the fall, the Farmhouse Project. So those are events where you could, go to, support, and have some fun. And then we're also launching a sponsorship program where businesses can actually sponsor the program and get different benefits for sponsorship, all the way from you can get a one-on-one drive along with us, get some special private tours at different farms, and then also some different, classes you can participate in. And then we're also launching a change at checkout program. So businesses can do a program where customers can round up, and then those proceeds will go to the Sullivan Fresh cupboard. So we're starting to launch all these programs, which we were already planning some part, in the past with this, but now we're, really launching this initiative.
It sounds like you guys have come up with some creative ways for fundraising. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are challenges around that. Mm-hmm. How are you addressing those challenges? And are you hopeful that the community will step up here and fill this gap?
Mm-hmm. I think challenges are, just the time. Obviously, we're so busy trying to run the program. And of course, everyone's out there trying to fundraise. So, being cognizant of that and cognizant of people's dollars. I think that's definitely, one part trying to work through. But I think, we've done, this program was started through grant funding to get it up and going. It is a lot logistically, and, it's increasing and the demand is there. We started off by, I think, serving with a cupboard a few hundred people a week. Now we're up to 700 and we have a wait list. And it's just really great how we have connected the farms into this model. So we're hopeful that, the community will support. But like I said, we're trying to also do events where people can go socialize and have fun, and they get something out of it as well.
How can folks get more involved in supporting the program and supporting for you and Sullivan Fresh Food?
Obviously, come to some of our events. We're going to have more information up on our website, sullivancce.org, in the next coming week. Some of the events are up there already. And then we're also looking for volunteers. If you want to get out in the summertime, we could also use volunteers at the Monticello Farmers Market or even at our community cupboard stops. So, and then the cupboard as well. But yeah, we could, you know, use some volunteers if you're interested. Even, you know, things can work on your own time. You can help us pack bags. We, like I said, we get out hundreds of bags every week, and it has a lot of fresh product in it. So we can always use help in that area as well.
And one of those cookie class fundraisers is tomorrow.
Yes, tomorrow. I should say that specifically. Thank you. It is tomorrow. See, as we say, we're so busy doing programming. It is tomorrow in our teaching kitchen. And we have Chef Erin Moore, who's actually a user in our kitchen, and she'll be teaching farm-to-table recipes, and that's at 6 o'clock. It is like $65, and you could go to our website, SullivanCC.org, or call us directly, 292-6180, and we can get you set up. And like I said, all the proceeds go directly to the program.
Learn to cook while supporting the food security program. Before we go, just, you know, what's been one of the most rewarding aspects of your work with Sullivan Fresh Food Security Program?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the most rewarding aspects is if you ever, you know, go to the Monticello Farmers Market in the summertime. We do these demonstrations at 11 o'clock, cooking demonstrations, and we get a lot of people from the senior community because we're, you know, we try to make it walkable where people can walk there. And there's also the meeting space right on the property. And we have, you know, the peak 50 people that come to these classes, and it's developed a community. Like, people have become friends. They've all got to know each other. So we've developed this community space that wasn't there before, while also exposing people to the great work that our farmers do in the county. And just like I said, being able to buy food for our program that was grown in our own county is just, you know, a great thing.
That's Melinda Meta, the Iagan Food Systems Senior Issue Leader at Cornell Cooperative Extension, Sullivan County. There's more information about the Sullivan Fresh Food Security Program and all of the services that Cornell Cooperative Extension, Sullivan County offers at their website, sullivancce.org. Melinda, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you again for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, another local program that is facing the possibility of major cuts in federal funding, Action Toward Independence. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
For the next jazz night in America, Sarah Hanahan, one of the rising stars of the alto saxophone.
My playing and my style, it would be a mix of all these people I've taken things from, including Bird and Jackie McLean, John Coltrane, and then taking my own take on it.
That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Join me Sunday at 8 here on Radio Catskill.
This week on This American Life, Daniel Sloss is a comedian. And after one of his shows, a fan walked up and told Daniel that he ended his marriage after watching Daniel's special. He even showed him the divorce papers. Then it happened again and again. Fans got in touch to say they'd broken up with their partners after seeing Daniel's show. The comedy routine powerful enough to end your marriage. Listen if you dare this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This morning, we're bringing you some stories about how the federal funding freeze announced by the Trump administration is destabilizing some local programs despite court interventions. Another one of those is Action Toward Independence, a nonprofit that offers counseling and special services to people with disabilities in need in the Catskills. Ever since the Trump administration started announcing these cuts in federal spending and the federal funding freeze, the organization has been knocking on doors and participating in public events to draw attention to those who benefit from their help. Action Toward Independence's executive director, Deborah Warden, spoke to Radio Catskills' Miguel Santiago Colon about what could be at risk if their funding is slashed.
Action Toward Independence, it's what's called an independent living center. And that kind of is a little confusing because people think a center is, you know, pretty much residential. But actually, we're a center of information for any individual who has a disability. Our goal is to empower and to help anyone to be living more independently. And we believe in the independent living philosophy and the personal choices of individuals with disabilities. Our agency has been around since the 80s, so we've been here for some time. And we are proudly serving Sullivan and Orange County.
And what's the mission that you promote? Like, what do you guys?
Yeah, we help anyone with a disability, and that kind of seems pretty open, right? But there's actually five core services that are specific to the things that we do. And the number one and most important, as far as I'm concerned, is that we are a peer-run organization. We provide peer counseling. And what that means is that we are an organization that we are required by executive order to have at least 51% of our staff have a disability, and over 51% of our board has to have a significant disability. So it's a peer run organization. So it's peers helping peers. So people in our office who have a disability, I think, have a unique perspective and definitely a level of empathy and compassion. So we help people. They come into our office and we apply for all different types of benefits and different types of applications that we assist them with, from employment to college to Social Security disability to SNAP to HEAP to anything in between. So we help people in providing them with support and giving them the place to come to be treated with dignity and respect as we help them navigate possibly a new life. We also help a lot of caregivers. Many times people with disabilities have a loved one, thankfully, who's able to provide that support. And caregivers are actually part of our target population because they too are more likely actually to experience depression, anxiety, health issues. They're not taking care of themselves necessarily as much as they should because they've been taking care of someone else. So we provide many of our supports, not only to the person directly, but also to a caregiver, a loved one.
You know, over the past month, the current administration has been eyeing or looking for ways to cut federal funding or federal spending. How would these services be affected if federal funding was just cut off?
That's a great question, and one that's unfortunately been much on our minds, especially it's not just us, but it's many small community-based organizations. So our funding is derived from federal, state, and local contracts. Unfortunately, some of the funding that comes from the state, it's funneled through the feds. So they are not able actually possibly to give us funding as well. So even though we're receiving state funding, that too can be interrupted. The biggest problem, and I've been around for a long time. I've been in this field. This is my 40th year in human services in Sullivan County. And I have been through budget cuts, cutbacks on programs, you know, that this is not a new landscape. I've never been through something like this where it can totally change our organization, if not possibly end it, because at the end of the day, the funding will depend upon whether or not you can promise not to provide DEI methodology or, you know, terminology or ideology, however the wording in the order is. I believe it's ideology. And the problem is that us, along with every independent living center in the country, we are nationwide, all of us are based upon advocating for the equity and inclusion of people with disabilities. That is the base of our organization, and it is a challenge to figure out how we are going to navigate a funding landscape that does not allow us to do the very services that we are being contracted to do.
Could you walk us through how people with disabilities might be affected with these changes?
Yeah. So for example, I'll give you one example. We have a veteran who went through, we have a service dog program. We are the proud and very honored agency to have the Joseph P. Dwyer Vet to Vet program. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but the Joseph P. Dwyer Vet to Vet program was brought about because Private First Class Joseph Dwyer came back from his service, and he unfortunately had PTSD and substance use disorder, and he greatly struggled. And unfortunately, he lost his battle, and his family really felt that they needed more of a peer connection to services for their loved one, that was missing, and that the VA perhaps did not provide that. So they advocated to New York State to create a peer program just for veterans. And it started off in a few counties, predominantly the Hudson Valley, because that's actually where Mr. Dwyer was from. And it has now expanded to every county in New York State. It has been so successful with connecting veterans. We ended up having the program as well as a grant through the Uniform University of Bethesda, Maryland, for a service dog program for veterans, because a service dog is very expensive and actually really cost prohibitive for a lot of veterans to obtain. So we got a grant to provide this program. So our funding allowed us to provide a service dog, connect this veteran. And not only that, here's where the advocacy comes in of ATI. His employer was not actually going to allow him to have a service dog because it actually was a problem with the policy, that he worked for a utility company, and the policy of the company was that trucks were not allowed to idle. But if you have a service dog, you need to have it temperature controlled. You know, if it's too hot, you can't leave the dog in the car, obviously, or if it's too cold. So we actually went in and did a presentation to the to the business, explained the purpose, explained what a reasonable accommodation was. And not only did the business agree to these changes, but they actually made the service dog an employee. She had her own employee file with her shot record and, you know, her license and everything. And he was able to maintain and keep employment. If agencies like ATI are not here, that veteran would not have been able to have kept his job.
So,
that's
so what you're,
one example.
Yeah. So what you're telling me is that people, not only would they stop receiving, you know, the help that they might need just to have a functional life, they might even lose their jobs.
Oh, 100%. Or lose their housing, perhaps. We have advocated for individuals with disabilities to have accommodations made to their apartment or something like that. Because, again, it's about, and this is where I think one of the biggest challenges and where it's needed most education. DEI is not a new concept. DEI is what brought you accessible parking spaces. DEI brought you accessible bathrooms with handlebars. DEI brought you adult changing tables that are now going to be put in the rest areas on every rest area in New York State and in their highway system. All these different things, reasonable accommodations, schools offering the ability for students to have have materials in a different format, for example, larger print, for example. My son, he unfortunately had, from a traumatic brain injury, a vertical vision disorder. So the school had to make an accommodation for him to still be able to learn. And he did. And he was able to graduate and go on to college and be a functioning adult, where, you know, if we didn't have that ability, I don't know what would have happened to him or the thousands of other students that rely upon their IEP, their individual education plan.
That's a pretty presentable argument. Have you, as a part of Action Toward Independence, presented that argument maybe to local representatives, town halls? If so, what answers have you received? What are the reactions?
Yes, I have presented. Yes, I'm trying to scream from the rooftops, actually, and trying to get the word out, because that's what I think is lacking, is that education for people to realize, you know, the ADA was, you know, signed into law and the funny thing is, a lot of people, when I do presentations about disability awareness, you know, because there's new language, for example, or how things have changed. And I do presentations and I always ask the audience, when was the ADA signed? And most times they usually say they relate to the Civil Rights Act, like 1960, 1970. It wasn't signed until 1990. You know, and so that's significant. The fact that we haven't even had these protections in place.
Yeah. 35 years ago only.
Yeah. For 35 years, you know, and we're still making strides, thankfully, and having a ramp put into a public building so that you can go vote if you happen to use accessibility equipment is significant. You would not be able to, you know, function in as a full participating citizen, perhaps, if you didn't have those accommodations.
Yeah, completely. What are you doing in the meantime? Do you have any events planned for the near future?
Well, we are constantly watching, obviously, any news that's coming down the pike. Currently, for this particular situation, the National Council on Nonprofits has filed the lawsuit that kind of gave us a stay that's holding off on any disruption in our funding at this point in time. So that's going on. And we just are hopeful that rational thinking prevails, that people understand that this is not about making something new. This is about us providing services that we have always been providing and trying to help people live their life to the fullest, whether they are utilizing a wheelchair, whether they're utilizing a white cane or hearing aids or not even having, you know, necessarily any device to help them. But so many of us have unseen disabilities that people are not even aware of a person going down the street that they could possibly have, you know, a significant disability. And that's also a thing because people think disability, they think a wheelchair or they think a walker, you know, they think something significant, but really the definition of a disability is someone with an access or functional need, period. So if you're a person who's on a medication, say for a chronic condition, say you have diabetes, you have a disability. It doesn't mean that you're disabled. We say a disability is just a different ability. You know, we have other skills that we can utilize that are amazing. And people with disabilities are least likely to be employed, for example. You know, they have a harder time finding a job and keeping that employment because employers think, oh gosh, I have to make some sort of accommodation for this person, when really it's not usually that much at all.
Yeah, you mentioned a pretty remarkable case where you actually helped someone with a disability to actually retain their job.
Yes.
Do you have a sense of how people with disabilities, you know, this community in your area, are reacting to the possibility of cuts in federal funding?
I think it has an impact. People are worried.
Have you gotten any calls yet?
Yeah,
for example?
We have. So, for example, one of our funds, we just recently were recipients of the STEP grant that's called Solutions to End Homelessness Program. That is a grant that comes through OTDA. That's the Office of Temporary Disability and Assistance. That's a New York State entity. But the funding comes from HUD. So where we are receiving a contract for $300,000 a year for 3 years that provides rental assistance, utility arrears assistance, possibly helping someone leave shelter because they've been experiencing homelessness for months, and then to try and get them into a place they are not able to save up for first month's rent, for example, we can help them do that to get them into secure housing. And we are getting calls from people wondering if that program is going to continue or not. And it is a concern because it is federal funds.
Deborah, is there anything you might want our audience to know about?
I would want them to know that they have a voice. They can make a phone call. They can advocate. Part of our job is teaching people how to advocate for themselves. Many times individuals with disabilities struggle with that. They don't necessarily have the tools or perhaps the confidence to say, these are, you know, my needs and how do I get them met? So that's why they come to us and other advocacy organizations similar to us. And I think that anyone who wants to know what we do and how we help, to please call us or visit our website or reach out to their representatives, their elected officials, and advocate that it's not just us, but other nonprofits who help people with individuals with disabilities and their caregivers, on how they can just get the voice out that we are in need of help. We need to be protected. We need to be secure in our funding. And I understand the premise, again, you know, not to be wasteful. You know, we feel, and it's been my experience with all the nonprofits that I have worked with, and believe me, it's been a lot, that everyone feels they have a fiduciary responsibility for taxpayer money. We we struggle with making sure our staff even have a living wage, because it's a joke that you work in a nonprofit. You're never going to get rich. You know, you make a living, not a killing. And that's really the philosophy. And how can I retain staff if I'm not even able to pay them a decent wage? And now they're not sure if they're going to have a job. How do I retain them? So it's really people who work in nonprofits do it for a passion and not a profit. They do it because they care and they have an amazing heart. And I would really want people to show their, you know, appreciation or their love for those people. It's my staff that I'm more worried about, you know, than anything else. So, and it's one of the challenges also of nonprofits that we don't have any money for marketing. You know, we do outreach and awareness, but we never get to put aside money to, you know, to do advertising for what we do and all that we accomplish. That's, you know, not something that we also have, that ability to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Deborah Wharton, from Action Toward Independence. Thank you so much for being, here with us in Radio Catskill. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Liberty, I'm Miguel Santiago Colón for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, strengthening our sense of community through conversation, the Committee for Equity and Justice is doing just that. We'll hear about more of that after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
Bradley Cooper, welcome to Fresh Air.
Tina Fey, welcome back.
Bryan Cranston, welcome.
Sarah Silverman,
Karl Rove,
Hillary Clinton,
Stephen Sondheim,
Robert Redford,
Lena Dunham, welcome to Fresh Air.
Welcome to Fresh Air.
Listen to Fresh Air Monday through Thursday at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, we're living in a world that's rapidly changing, some of it to our liking and some of it not, with all that's going on. How do we maintain and strengthen our sense of community? The Committee for Equity and Justice, a subcommittee of Sullivan allies leading together, says it's time to listen and share and gain a better understanding of how we can build a vibrant community together. They're hosting a community conversation at the E.B. Crawford Public Library in Monticello tomorrow. And joining us this morning with more information about that from the Committee for Equity and Justice is Judy Balaban. Judy, good to see you.
Hi, good morning.
We were talking before we came on here about community and why it's so important. So in a time when communities seem really polarized more than ever, how do you see an event like this community conversation helping us find common ground?
Right. Well, I think that when people sit down and talk and listen really being the operative word, it kind of helps us think maybe a little bit outside of ourselves. And that's really important. One of the focuses on the community conversations is to take a look at our thoughts and perspectives on a particular topic and try to explore where those perspectives came from. And that can be very enlightening. The conversations are not there to change anybody's minds or tell them what to think. The conversations are there to help people think. And, we've been doing this since, I think September of 2023, once a month. And, the feedback that I've gotten from many people is that it really has broadened their perspectives on many things.
Talk a little bit more about the Committee for Equity and Justice's mission and how the role of dialogue and this open conversation play into that.
Well, the committee's mission, if I recollect it,
you don't have to read verbatim.
Right. is basically to bring community together, to meet the needs of the community. The Committee for Equity and Justice, we do a donation cook once a week. Actually, it's going on right now over at the food pantry in Calicoon. And then that food gets distributed along with food from other sources. Martin Calavito and other volunteers go out and they deliver it to people. That's become more and more important because some of members of our community are afraid to leave their homes right now. And it's kind of heartbreaking to think that, but that's what's going on. So, you know, so that's one of the things. Sedge and Salt, we do a lot of outreach and, you know, and a lot of other things. But basically, it's to strengthen our community and meet those needs.
You're talking about folks in the immigrant community?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so a lot of I don't think that yeah, so basically we're aware that a lot of our neighbors who may be undocumented are afraid to go to work, to send their kids to school, and it's kind of heartbreaking.
With so many voices being heard on so many different types of platforms, why do you think that face-to-face dialogue is important, and what role does that have in community building?
Oh, my goodness. Face-to-face dialogue is, you know, we cannot let that be a thing of the past. And, you know, people don't say the same things that they might say on their, you know, on social media. You know, because you're not looking at the person that you may be causing a lot of pain to. You know, you're not seeing the reaction. You're not seeing the commonalities. You're not seeing who you're hurting. So face-to-face is really, really very, very important. And when we have enough people in a group, you know, that comes on the second Thursday of every month, then we break up into smaller groups. And so people are more comfortable maybe sharing their ideas and their thoughts. And then we bring it back to the larger group. And one of the other things that we do is once people talk about their perspectives and share that information, we usually talk about the same topic for two or three sessions. So we'll ask people to go home and research the validity of their perspective in terms of data and in terms of, you know, are you going to get your information from a more conservative source or a more progressive source? And when you look at both of those sources, is the information the same? Where do they overlap? And what does that tell you? So we try to do a little bit more exploration so that, as I said initially, people start to think. And I mean, I have felt that myself. And, you know, I felt that myself when I was doing the One Small Step here, you know.
Right. You were one of the facilitators for our One Small Step initiative in partnership with StoryCorps last year.
Right. And listening to some of those conversations, it was like, oh, wait a minute. Let me rethink my, you know, my ideas on this topic. Or I have a reaction to a particular person because of what they said. And now I'm recognizing that as a reaction instead of a thoughtful response. So we're trying to get people to pause once they react and maybe have a more thoughtful response.
Is that how you're trying to encourage folks to take more meaningful action toward building a more inclusive community rather than just listening to them? You're asking them to, okay, pause, think, analyze, and then try to move this outward and take action on some of this, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, in the past, we have had discussions like we discussed Atteris, which was the new town, the new village that was formed between Fallsburg and Thompson. Mm-hmm. And we had like we spent about 3 months, three different sessions on that. And we didn't, you know, if people who were there wanted to become active, then they could. The group itself the community conversation group did not go in that direction. We may be rethinking that now because it's so important. If we could bring people together from different political viewpoints who recognize, no, this is important. We need to make sure that we have checks and balances in our government. So all of us need to contact our representatives, whether they're Democratic representatives or Republican representatives. And we can do that en masse if we bring people together. That's why it's so important for people to come to this conversation who have different political viewpoints. And historically, we've had people who are more liberal come. But not always. We certainly have had people right. who, yeah.
And you're encouraging folks of all viewpoints to
absolutely.
Come to talk.
Absolutely. Every voice matters. And I think that, given the situation and the climate today, we can find a lot of things that we agree upon. And then we've got more power. And I hear from a lot of people and a lot of friends, well, there's nothing I can do. And, we can't change the world like overnight, but we've got to recognize we have some power. We've got to feel empowered because otherwise it's very, very unhealthy.
Kind of goes back to that program you worked with us on, Just Take One Small Step. For someone who, though, may be thinking about coming to this and aren't sure, maybe they think maybe that it's going to be a continuation of what they're seeing on social media or just in media in general, this very heated, polarized atmosphere. What would you say to them to become a part of this conversation? What would you do to encourage them to participate?
Well, we have group agreements so that we keep things on an even keel. I'm an experienced facilitator. In the past, we've had Adrienne Jensen has joined us as a facilitator. She's like so busy with so many things now that she's not available anymore. Kathy Aberman, who's one of the sweetest human beings that exist, is also part of the facilitating groups. And now Tracy Boyles has joined us, who's also an experienced facilitator.
So you've got some experienced hands there to help guide this conversation.
To committee. Help guide that and to make sure that anyone who... we have had conversations in the past that did not fit our mission very well because people felt so strongly about this particular topic that they were not really listening to each other. Mm-hmm. So I encourage you, if you come, we want to hear from you, no matter what your political viewpoint, but we ask that you're willing to listen.
Where can folks get more information about this community conversation that's happening tomorrow and more information about the Committee for Equity and Justice?
Well, come to the conversation. We'll give you more information on the committee. You can find out more information on that on the SALT website, which I don't have in front of me.
Yeah, I got it for you.
Community conversation is, as you said, tomorrow, 6 to 7:30 at the Ethel B. Crawford Public Library. And their calendar has more information there. So I encourage people to come. It is so important that we have community. We count on each other no matter what our politics are. When, the proverbial poop hits the fan, we count on each other, and that's not going to change. But we could do even more.
Now more than ever. Judy Balaban is with the Committee for Equity and Justice. It's a subcommittee of Sullivan Allies Leading Together, or SALT. There's more information at saltcares.com. You can also email salt@saltcares.com. Judy Balaban, thank you so much. It's good to see you.
Oh, thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to the world record mountain climber. Vern Tejas joins us after this. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
I'm Mimi Bradley, Radio Catskills Development Manager, reminding you that a great way to keep public radio here in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania is by becoming a Sound Supporter. Sound Supporters give small amounts, $20, $30, $50 a month or more, that add up to a big help. Plus, Sound Supporters get special thank yous, like drawings for tickets to events in our community throughout the year. Become a Sound Supporter. Go to wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, last year, a volunteer at the Frederick Cook Society opened an old cabinet in the back of the Cook Gallery and discovered an envelope containing two small objects wrapped in bubble wrap. The objects were rocks taken from the summit of Mount Denali, and a note in the envelope explained that the mountain climber Vern Tejas rappelled 100 feet down the mountain to collect these rocks to help prove that Frederick Cook's description of the summit as granite was correct. Tomorrow, the Frederick Cook Society is presenting an afternoon talk with Vern, the world record-holding mountain climber. And Vern Tejas joins us now along with Carol Smith from the Frederick Cook Society. Hello.
Hey, Tim. Hey, Carol. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for being here. Vern, you have such a career filled with incredible achievements. You've made history, solo climbs with some of the most challenging peaks on Earth. Can you just share with us folks who don't climb mountains an experience that truly tested your limits, either physically or mentally?
Well, it's a lifelong career, Tim. I've been acting as a mountain guide for 43 years now, and I've been very fortunate, climbed all over the world. By far, the hardest physically has been Everest, and there's several instances up there where it's tried to kill me. So I have a lot of respect for it. After climbing it 10 times, I called it quits for Everest. But I'm still active and taking people. Just got back from climbing in Africa. I did 3 Kilimanjaro climbs there with teams.
Now, about this climb to the summit of Denali and discovering these rocks, bringing these rocks back, what's the significance of those rocks and how it relates to Dr. Frederick Cook's legacy?
Well, the two rocks that I brought back were of different nature. The dark black one is argillite. It's a sedimentary rock. And the lighter one is actually a light granite. And when Cook described what the summit looked like, he said it was granite. And his detractors said, no, it was argillite. But what I found up there, which I'd seen throughout the mountain, is it's made of, the summit is composed of both types of rock. So the fact that there's detractors said that it was impossible because he couldn't even describe it correctly. He said it was granite and it's actually argillite. That's not true. It's actually a composition of both types of the rocks. The whole Denali uplift is a big granite, what they call a batholith, which was a large bubble of molten magma that then solidified underneath the crust. And then as it was pushed up, it formed the range. But the mountain itself has the overlying sedimentary rock on top of this granite. And so that's actually what the bulk of the mountain is made out of, is two different types of rocks right at the interface.
Carol, Dr. Cook, the American explorer born down the road here in Hortonville, New York, some of his exploration claims have been debated for years. So
yes.
How was this discovery in the back of this cabinet right. So important to you guys at the Frederick Cook Society?
Right. Well, the entire controversy came to light around 1909, and then Cook's detractors attacked his climb of Denali because it was easy to attack that climb. It was not easy to attack the North Pole. You can't really prove somebody was at the North Pole. So
Cook's climbing partner was paid $5,000 to lie in an affidavit and say that Cook never got there.
Wow.
And so some of the researchers went back and met this climber, Ed Burrell, his family. And yes, indeed, he was a mountain guide who suddenly became super rich. And he signed an affidavit that you know, denied Frederick Cook's life's work, basically, which set off years and years of misery and suffering. And Cook's legacy was nearly destroyed. The Cook Society has existed for 30, 40 years now, trying to fight back against that early propaganda.
Vern, you've said that, you know, climbing for you is metaphorical about discovering your limits and exploring your internal world. But then you have this discovery like this that helps, you know, better understand someone's legacy here, Dr. Cook's legacy. What does that mean for you?
Well, I like to be on the right side of history, but to be able to bring an artifact to light that would basically change the equation, because it's significant in the discussion of whether or not he made it there. To me, that's my contribution to history is to bring things to light that people don't know or want to believe. So for me, it is very gratifying to be part of that, the process of turning up this significant discrepancy in the argument against Dr. Cook's having gotten to the top of Denali.
Is that what you're most excited to share with your audience during the talk tomorrow at the Frederick Cook Society, or what are you looking forward to?
I would like to see the rocks. It's been many years, but I would like to share with them the viability of not only his route, but also of the climbing techniques that he used. He was very ahead of his time. Most everybody climbs at what we say a 3-week time frame. He claimed to do it in 8 days, which many of the authorities said was impossible. But I know that's a different style of climbing. Most people, like I say, climb it three weeks. How could he climb it in 8 days? It's two different styles of climbing, and I'd like to discuss that with the audience tomorrow.
Carol, let's remind folks where and when and how for the
sure.
talk tomorrow.
Yes, we start at 1 o'clock tomorrow at the Sullivan County Museum, 265 Main Street in Hurleyville. There'll be a little bit of live music afterwards because Vern plays a small Martin guitar and likely to be some sparrows hanging around. There'll be some refreshments, kind of a light lunch, and 845-434-8044 if you have questions.
The FrederickCookSociety.org as well. Before we go, Vern, any peaks you haven't summited that still call to you, even though I know you say you've retired?
Well, I haven't retired, but I'm not going up Everest anymore.
Okay, see.
I'd love to get up K2. I'd also like to climb the second highest mountain in Indonesia. Wow. But most people aren't even aware where Indonesia is, so I won't go into that too much. But yeah, there's all us climbers always have a list of things we want to get around to.
It's still there for you to reach those peaks.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. The dreaming never dies.
All right. Vern Tejas, thank you so much for joining us. And Carol Smith from the Frederick Cook Society. You can hear Vern's talk tomorrow. And thank you guys very much. It's very,
thank you, Tim.
Very interesting. Cool.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, you can hear our program and all of our local programs at our website, wjffradio.org. And you can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there. Get it in your inbox on Fridays, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering 4 counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point.
Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, much cooler today than yesterday. Some clouds this afternoon, high around 45. Cloudy, a shower or some wet snow even possible tonight, a low of 28. Tomorrow, cloudy, high 46, but we'll warm back up Friday 55, Saturday 54, and Sunday 61 with some rain expected.